You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A couple of years ago, Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post foreign correspondent Steve Faneru had himself embedded with a group of private security contractors in Iraq. And in his new book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, he chronicles their dangerous work and the expansion of the private security industry. The book is published by DeCapo Press. I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Faneru to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Are we talking about companies like Blackwater?
Exactly, yeah. And when I first started looking into this world, that was really, that company and a few others were really the only ones that I had heard about. And I had been in Iraq at that point for some 14 months covering the U.S. military. But what I found out was that there were literally hundreds of companies that were doing private security work in Iraq, and they employed, tens of thousands of essentially hired guns who were operating and filling military roles within the war to make up for a shortfall of troops that had occurred because simply there never were enough troops in Iraq.
So is the Crescent Security Group, with whom you embedded, doing work similar to Blackwater?
They were. Blackwater, of course, is under a State Department contract, and they were protecting the U.S. ambassador and American diplomats as they traveled around Baghdad. Crescent Security Group was a much smaller company. It was, I call it in the book, sort of the Kmart of private security. Blackwater had 1,000 people in Iraq, helicopters and incredibly sophisticated armored vehicles. Crescent traveled into Iraq in pickup trucks, and they were under a contract with the Italian military, which was withdrawing its troops from Iraq. And the Italian military, because it essentially did not want to put its own troops in harm's way as it was withdrawing this material from the country, hired this small private security company to do the job.
Had you been embedded before in Iraq when you were covering the occupation?
I had been. I had been embedded with the U.S. military for about a year and a half, and I had covered all through the end of 2004 and 2005. I had covered the sort of the role of U.S. troops in the ground war in Iraq, and I traveled all over the country with the U.S. military, but I had never embedded effectively with a private security firm. And what I found it was a completely different ballgame. It was staggering in many respects. The most glaring, of course, was that the military, which operates under strict legal code, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, with the private security contractors, there essentially were no rules. The U.S. occupation government had given immunity to prosecution under the Iraqi law to the contractors in 2004, but it was never clear what international or U.S. laws applied to their actions. And when I talked to some contractors about what rules applied to them, one contractor told me that if there was ever a move made by the Iraqi government to try to prosecute them, they would literally ship them out of the country in the back of a car in the middle of the night. And they said they had this expression called big boy rules, which effectively meant that they had their own rules. They policed themselves under their own system of justice.
Given to them by the Coalition Provisional Authority Memorandum Number 17.
Exactly. It was sort of an officially sanctioned immunity from prosecution.
So they could do whatever they want and just get away with it?
Essentially. I mean, by the time I started looking into this, there had been some four dozen cases in which U.S. servicemen in Iraq had been charged with murder under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Not a single private security contractor had been charged with a crime. And I became sort of acutely aware of the impunity issues when I heard about an incident where a private security contractor, sort of a modern mercenary, if you will, was working for a company called Triple Canopy, and he announced to his colleagues one day that he wanted to shoot somebody. He really felt like he wanted to shoot somebody.
Just wanted to go hunting.
Essentially, yeah, that was the implication. And, his colleagues sort of, they didn't really take him seriously. He was sort of prone to giving kind of outlandish remarks. But when they got out on the airport road that day, the Baghdad airport road, according to the other three men who were in the vehicle with him, he pushed open his door and fired several rounds from his weapon into the windshield of a civilian taxi. And when that happened, It created all kinds of confusion with the company. The three other men who were in the vehicle were, by their accounts, mortified by what had happened. There was a Fijian who went to his supervisor, who was also Fijian, but the Fijian was scared to go to the Americans to tell them what had happened. The two other Americans who were in the vehicle waited 2 days and then reported the incident to their supervisor, who was also an American. And the response of the company was essentially to fire the two Americans who had reported the incident, and also the person who was also accused of the incident. But what really sort of amazed me was that, you know, even by the accused operator's own admission, you know, he had been accused of essentially attempted murder, but there was no legal mechanism to deal with that. The company sort of reported a vague shooting incident to the director of security for the Green Zone, where the company was headquartered. But of course, the incident had happened outside the Green Zone, and he essentially said, you know, not my job, and that as a criminal action, the incident died from there.
You covered the war in Iraq. Did you come home in between covering the war and then doing this?
I did.
So
I
was
did.
It hard to go back?
You know, it's really interesting, and I try to deal with this in the book. You know, I came home at the end of 2005, and, you know, what I found was, like a lot of people who have been through Iraq, you know, it creates, when you come back, I think it really creates a tremendous, for lack of a better word, a tremendous void in your life. You know, you sort of miss the intensity of experience that you have in covering the war or simply participating in the war.
You mean becoming an adrenaline junkie, as some journalists have described it as.
I think as a journalist, I missed the sort of sense of purpose. It was certainly the most meaningful story I had covered in my career. And it's very difficult to replicate that, I think, for many, many people. And, you know, I found myself in a certain way identifying with the people who had come back to do these jobs, because, you know, the great majority of them were not psychopaths like this, you know, like the incident I described. I mean, there were people who had largely gone through the military themselves. They had served their country admirably. They had acquired skills that allowed them to go back to Iraq under official U.S. government sanctioned jobs that paid them many, many times more than they would have been able to make in the United States. And of course, they were chasing in many ways some of the same issues that I had been chasing. And so, you know, the people who were actually doing the job, I found the farther I got into it, the more and more difficulty I had to really feel any judgment about sort of what they were doing. But the practice of, you know, of outsourcing essentially, you know, the solemn responsibility for deciding who could kill and die for our country, you know, I thought raised enormous questions for the entire war.
And as you've been suggesting, although the focus of your book is on a few men working for a private security company in Iraq, this is also about your own family struggles and your personal struggles. Why did you think that was important?
I'm sorry?
Why did you think that was important to include?
You know, it's a really good question, and I found myself, I wasn't planning on it, but I felt like if I was going to sort of lay bare these many complicated issues that had driven these people back to Iraq, that I kind of had to come clean myself, because I was sort of, you know, I felt like I was sort of in the same position. I went back and forth with it, and even after the book was done, I thought about taking it out, but in the end, I felt like it was relevant. I felt like it was relevant to the honesty of the book, frankly. And it wasn't really easy, I would have to say. But I think it's totally relevant to what was going on. You know, the main character in my book is a guy named John Cote, who had been in the 82nd Airborne as a paratrooper. He had done combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. He got out of the army as an E-5, a sergeant. He was making $1,900 a month. He enrolled at the University of Florida as an accounting major. And when he got there, you know, it should have been utopia for him. He was just an incredibly charismatic guy. He's a beautiful guy who seemed to attract, you know, hundreds and hundreds of friends, people who were magnetized by him in the same way I sort of was. And, you know, he was just sort of a really captivating figure. But when he got to Florida, you know, he just didn't fit in. He could not make it. He found, like, you know, he was surrounded by 18-year-old people. He told his brother that he felt like he'd already lived, you know, two lifetimes compared to the people he was going to school with. And one of his Army buddies came to him and said, you know, you can make $7,000 a month, you know, protecting supply convoys in Iraq. And I met him about 2 months after he had gotten back to Iraq, and I spent some time with him. And right after I came back, he was kidnapped, and then was later killed, in southern Iraq. And so the book very much follows his odyssey. And I guess I felt that in a way, if I was going to describe his his trajectory in Iraq and what had brought him back, that in a very small way I needed to sort of describe my own.
Do you know how many private contractors have been killed in Iraq?
I don't think we're ever going to know. I really don't. You know, it's the Department of Labor, amazingly enough, keeps the figures, the casualty figures for contractors, because there's something called the Defense Base Act, which is essentially assurance policy for contractors who are working in conjunction with the U.S. with U.S. military. But there are many companies, including Crescent Security Group, the company that I most document in the book, that did not have Defense Base Act insurance. There are a lot of companies that were simply just operating, you know, off the grid in Iraq. And so, you know, and those people, they employed not just Americans, but people from countries like Fiji and Peru and Colombia and Mexico, just all over the world, and a lot of those people were not covered, you know, by Defense Base Act insurance. So I'm not sure that we'll ever know. The Labor Department figures suggest that it's hundreds and perhaps thousands of people.
And you call them mercenaries in your title. Do private security contractors see themselves that way?
Yeah, you know, many of them are offended by the term. You know, they feel like they're doing work that is sanctioned by the government. Many of them said, you know, under the definition, you have to be working for another country that's not your own to be accurately described as a military. You know, and even in the Washington Post, where I work, you know, we didn't describe them as mercenaries. I think because the term had become so politically charged. But in the book, I use the word liberally, and the reason is I think we should call the practice what it is. These are people who are being paid to fight the war on behalf of the United States.
And who's paying them? Who hires them?
Well, you and I are. I mean, U.S. taxpayers are. And they're out there. They're out on the battlefield, and they're getting killed, and they're killing people themselves, and they're getting involved in combat. And I always felt the term private security contracting didn't come close to really describing the activity that was going on.
Well, is the way that they're being used in Iraq different from the way mercenaries were used in the past?
Yeah, I think it is. Well, particularly for the United States, because, you know, in the past, principally they've been used in supporting roles in a much, much smaller scale. Just for example, in the most recent war, the Gulf War, the ratio of contractors to conventional forces was 1 to 10, one contractor for every troop. And, you know, in Iraq, the last count from the Congressional Budget Office was that there were an estimated 190,000 contractors of all stripes who are working in Iraq, and the number of troop levels have sort of varied from between 135 and 160,000. So there's more contractors than troops in Iraq. Now I'm focusing on a subset of that group, the private security people, the hired guns, you know, the modern mercenaries. And even now, no one really knows how many of them there are. The Pentagon has estimated 25,000, at least 25,000, which in itself is a huge number. It's more than an additional division. But, you know, some people think it's as high as 50,000 or even more.
My guest is Steve Fainaru, Fainaru, winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for International Reporting. His book, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, it's published by DeCapo. And you describe in the book moments when President Bush and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld were asked about private security contractors. We have a clip of President Bush responding to a student's questions at Johns Hopkins University in April 2006. I'd like to play that now.
I asked your Secretary of Defense a couple months ago what law governs their actions. Mr.
I'm going to ask him. Go ahead. Help.
Well, I was hoping your answer might be a little more specific. Mr. Rumsfeld answered that Iraq has its own domestic laws, which he assumed apply to those private military contractors. However, Iraq is clearly not currently capable of enforcing its laws, much less against, you know, over our American military contractors. I would submit to you that in this case, this is one case that privatization is not a solution. Mm. And Mr. President, how do you propose to bring private military contractors under a system of law?
Yeah, I appreciate that very much. I wasn't kidding. I'd pick up the phone and say, Mr. Secretary, I got an interesting question. This is what delegation, I don't mean to be dodging the question, although it's kind of convenient in this case, but never. I really will. I'm going to call the secretary and say, you brought up a very valid question, and what are we doing about it? That's how I work. Thanks.
That is kind of illuminating, isn't it? How much do you think President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld actually knew at the time about the specific jobs being carried out by the private contractors?
Well, I think his answer speaks for itself. You know, it's interestingly enough, you know, of course, that exchange is in the book as well. And, you know, it was preceded by an exchange where Rumsfeld showed up at Hopkins, and the same woman asked him the question, and he said that, well, Iraq, he kind of stammered, and then Iraq is a sovereign nation, and sort of suggested that these contractors were under Iraqi law, which, of course, was completely untrue. You know, I think that was one of the things that really, really amazed me when I started looking into this this issue, that the government, and including the military, really seemed to have very little understanding of the magnitude of the industry as it applied to the war, and what the rules were. No one really seemed to know what the rules were that applied to their actions. And at the same time, you had what we all know now were many, many shooting incidents that were going on with these companies. I mean, there's one company that we looked into, Armor Group International. It's a British company, and they were handling like one third of all non-military supply convoys in Iraq. It's a huge volume of convoys, and convoy protection in Iraq is just about the most dangerous job that you can do. It's these lumbering convoys that are sort of moving targets. And Armor Group, over a one-year period in 2006, was getting hit every 2.5 times it went out on a mission. So every other mission, essentially, they were getting attacked. And of course, some of these were bomb attacks, some of these were small arms fire, and they were shooting back. So, but again, there was never really any clarity about what the rules were. So if there were engagements, you know, what were the rules of procedure?
Was it difficult to obtain information about the contractor's work from government officials?
Well, when I went to the State Department, I mean, I think it's important to differentiate the different contracts, because, you know, Blackwater, for example, was under a State Department contract. Armor Group, for example, was under a Defense Department contract. And so it varied kind of according to the government agency. When you went to the State Department to ask them about Blackwater and shooting incidents and sort of what the rules were and how incidents were investigated, it was, you know, it was a complete void. You could get almost no information in return.
Could you use the Freedom of Information Act to get any information?
We did FOIA requests to try to get the contracts. We had problems there. It was just very, very difficult. And I was, especially compared to my experience with the military, where I'd been embedding. And then, of course, you know, the industry by definition is private, and so you had to rely kind of on the cooperation of the, you know, of the companies to allow you to, you know, to talk to them. You know, they didn't have to go to the military and ask for permission. They could either say yes or no. And some companies were quite transparent, actually, and some of them, you know, like Blackwater, were not.
How closely did you bond with the private contractors from the Crescent Security Group? First of all, was it Was it difficult to win their trust?
You know, I think that with even my experience in the military was similar. I think that a lot of people who were in Iraq regarded the media with a degree of suspicion at best, I guess. And when I got to Crescent, all these guys had been through the military themselves. And so I think they were a little bit wary. You know, I just came to them. I felt like I came to them honestly. I honestly wanted to know why they were there and what they were doing and what their jobs were like and how it compared with the military experience that I had seen so much of. And I found that, you know, like a lot of people, this is true of the soldiers too in Iraq, a lot of people would like to know, people to know what their lives are like in Iraq, what they're doing and what roles they're playing, because they feel honestly that they're making a contribution to the war. And many of these people feel like that contribution, you know, is not being acknowledged. And so I think on that basis, I was able to establish, you know, a good relationship with them.
But did you ever feel a concern that the men you were bonding with might act illegally or immorally under the big boy rules and that you might have to expose them in your reporting?
I did. Of course I did. You know, while I was with Crescent, you know, nothing like that occurred. But then, of course, after the kidnapping, I began to do more research into the company, and you know, I began to hear about shooting incidents involving other contractors, not the ones that I had met, where there was one incident where the company was attacked in a small town called Al-Afem, north of Baghdad, and the company's response to that was every time after that they went through this town, they laid down preemptive fire, sort of literally going through this town, guns blazing. You know, I guess it's not surprising that if incidents were going to occur, you know, they would not necessarily occur with a journalist present. But at the same time, you know, the people I met, I did feel, you know, I understood why they were there. They felt like they were completely alone. The company was shoddy. You know, they were driving around in these very flimsy pickups. They had very few resources. You know, Crescent operators were being paid $7,000 a month, whereas a Blackwater contractor might have been paid $15,000 or even $20,000 a month. And so,
let me follow up on that. They felt like they were doing something important, but they didn't reenlist in the military. They took these jobs partly, I'm sure, because they could make so much more money than they could if they were just regular soldiers.
Exactly. And I find that there's a lot of sort of morally ambiguous stuff going on here. You know, I always felt these were jobs that were, you know, they're sort of offered to the chronically underpaid in our society. You know, the people in the military and the, you know, cops and firefighters. And I say in the book, you know, if they started handing out $20,000 a month, $20,000 a month jobs to elementary school teachers in Iraq, you know, they would have flooded in by the thousands. But at the same time, you're right, they didn't reenlist in the military. Some of them had tried to reenlist, and then either they were too old or they hadn't made it back in, and they had seen these other opportunities. Some of them said, look, I get all the great stuff about the military, you know, the intensity, the experience, camaraderie, but without all the rules that you have to, you know, you have to be under in the military. So I think it's a mixed bag.
A number of journalists I've spoken to have talked about what you discussed earlier, the adrenaline addiction. But then some of them have also told me that they've experienced symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of what they saw or some of the things that they actually endured. Has that been a problem for you?
You know, I'm not sure how to describe it, really. What I experienced when I came back, before I went back, was a feeling of loss, of a tremendous void in my life that could not be replaced while I was home. Not just the adrenaline, but sort of the meaning of it. You felt that everything around you was, I don't want to say meaningless, but you know, it just did not have the sort of heightened importance that you felt while you were in Iraq. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, I went back to Iraq. I did it I kept going back through the end of last year. By the end of the year, I really felt whatever was going on inside my head about needing to be there was gone. And now I feel absolutely no need to go back. And I don't know what causes that to turn on and off.
If he were advising President Barack Obama about this situation, what would you tell him?
You know, I'd tell him it's an incredibly dangerous proposition to introduce civilian combatants into a war zone, and that if you are going to rely on private security, I'm not at the sort of place where a lot of people are that you should just ban these people entirely. I think they can have a useful purpose in peacekeeping operations, in protecting sort of static bases and things like that. But when you unleash them into the battlefield, it just creates enormous problems that no matter how many laws or rules you try to impose, cannot really be enforced.
Steve Fenneru is a foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, where he covered the war in Iraq from 2004 to 2007. He was a Pulitzer finalist in 2006 for his coverage of U.S. troops as the insurgency in Iraq intensified. And then he won the Pulitzer this year for international reporting, also received the Overseas Press Club's Hal Boyle Award for Best Newspaper or Wire Service Reporting from Abroad for stories on these private security contractors. His book on that subject, Big Boy Rules, America's Mercenaries Fighting in Iraq, is published by DeCapo Press. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.